Россия должна быть суверенной и влиятельной.
Наша задача создать богатую и благополучную
создать
Россию.
И модернизировать 25 миллионов рабочих мест. И сохранить.
He's vowed to strengthen the economy and the military. He warned the West against meddling in Russia's affairs. He urged families to have more children. He pledged to uphold traditional spiritual values. He promised to create 25 million jobs and fight corruption. And wait, haven't we heard all this before? There was a lot of anticipation for Vladimir Putin's State of the Nation address this week, his first since returning to the Kremlin in May. Some media speculated he would reshuffle the government. Some reported that he would use the speech to unveil a rebranded Putin the Wise Patriarch. Some Kremlin watchers even thought the address would signal a pivot to more liberal policies. But what everybody got was boilerplate. Anti-corruption blogger and opposition leader Alexei Navalny summed up the speech in a sarcastic tweet, quote, "Everything will be fine soon, I promise," unquote. Meanwhile, a mass demonstration planned by the opposition for this weekend is being scaled back considerably after Moscow authorities declined to approve the route and location. So Putin's big speech falls flat, and the opposition's big demo comes up short. Is the year that began with a roar ending with a dud? Hello, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. My regular co-host, Kirill Kobrin of RFERL's Russian service, is back from his Arctic adventures and is in the studio with me. Welcome back, Kirill.
Thank you, and hello.
And on the Skype line from New York City is NYU professor Mark Galliotti, an expert on Russia's security services and author of the must-read blog, In Moscow's Shadows. Welcome, Mark.
Glad to be back.
Kirill, I obviously thought Putin's speech was a bit of a dud, but you have much more experience than I do in reading between the lines and these kind of things, going way back to the early Brezhnev period, I do believe.
Late Brezhnev, I think.
Early Brezhnev.
I'm not so old.
We were about the same age. But when you and I were talking off mic yesterday, you indicated that there was much more to Putin's speech than initially meets the eye. So why don't you enlighten our listeners with your experience in listening to Soviet style speeches.
So it could be like I joined the ranks of Putin admirers, but it's not so, obviously. Anyway, this speech was rather interesting for me. First of all, you mentioned this Putin the Wise Patriarch thing. It's a kind of new PR, strategy for Putin 3.0. I think if we consider this speech from this point of view, this is a very successful speech for, Old Testament patriarch. First of all, what does it mean? First of all, not to claim, but to avoid or to be silenced on especially, important or, some dubious things. So he didn't say anything about the most important things about, about political processes and criminal cases against the opposition leaders. He didn't say, a word about awful situation in Russian military, not in the military defense, Ministry of Defense, but in Russian military at all. He didn't say a word about the situation in Russian police in the context of all the scandals of this.
So what he didn't say was as important as what he did say.
Yes, because, he avoided this, but this trick wasn't obvious when you listened to the speech. And that is, I think, it's a very, high quality, the result of very high quality.
What's the point of not mentioning all these things?
I'll explain in several minutes. Secondly, what is the, part of the role of every patriarch, old patriarch, patriarch of Old Testament, if you want, always to be on the brink of being obvious. not to be dull and so on, but on the brink of being so, just using the, you know, the ready-made thoughts, the ready-made, you know, things, the ready-made ideas, words, and so on, but to combine it, somehow, not to be, you know, extremely dull.
Mm-hmm.
Modestly dull, yes, but not extremely dull. And that is the difference, by the way, I'm speaking about PR effect, yeah? Mm-hmm. And that is the difference, by the way, between Putin today, I don't know what will come, you know, next year or next, you know, 10 years in his speeches, but it's a great difference with Brezhnev, because Brezhnev was extremely dull, and that's why he was extremely funny and ridiculous. Putin isn't so. And my third point, I'm still on the PR thing, that Patriarch couldn't be ridiculed or to be hated just directly in his position, you know, just after he delivered a speech. That was absolutely the same with Putin. All these opinions by experts, they was, you know, not very happy with the speech. They said that it was dull, that it was so and so, so, but no one told that this situation or this speech was, you know, ridiculous.
But what was the goal of all this? Why would he want to be dull?
So that is my, you know, second strategic point. In the context of the third term, Putin has to come to terms with all, in one or other way, with all serious political forces in Russia. Economic, you know, social and political and cultural, by the way, forces in Russia or groups. And he cannot, you know, he couldn't attack someone. Don't forget that he delivered this speech just before, 2-3 days before all these protests, which are or were appointed on this Sunday.
The Saturday.
Yeah, sorry, Saturday. And he didn't, you know, he didn't want to fuel the protest with some insulting comments, which he did, you know, in the beginning of this year,
mm-hmm.
when he told about these banderlogs and so
right.
on. So he tried to avoid this, you know, direct confrontation, not to insult the opposition, trying to be not insulted.
Mm-hmm.
And that is very important.
So is this a sign that he's come to terms with the opposition?
Not with all opposition, but I think that he is coming to terms with the idea that some kind of opposition outside Duma can exist in Russia during his third term. That is the point.
He doesn't have much of a choice in that matter.
I don't know how his you know mechanism of his consciousness
right.
is working, but I think that he used to live this year. Maybe this is the most important psychological result for Putin president, is that he used to live in one country with some opposition.
Mm-hmm. And now he's become accustomed to this.
Yes, yeah. And this speech in some sense was the outcome of this, you know, understanding. Mm-hmm. That is my idea.
Mark, you and I were talking off mic yesterday and you had a little bit of a different opinion about this.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure whether or not Putin will treasure Kirill's appraisal that he's presented the appropriate levels of dullness. I mean, I take the point about the fact that, I mean, I think Kirill's quite right about the sort of, that Putin would not have wanted to throw any fuel on the flames. So there's necessarily wasn't a time to ridicule the opposition or to provide other sort of grounds for them. But nonetheless, I did find this a pretty disappointing speech, and it very much, it almost sounded sort of Stalin-esque in its life is getting better, comrades, life is getting brighter. Sure, he gave a confident performance. I mean, just watching him speak, it's clear he was trying to sort of very much go back to the sort of Putin, the strong, confident executive. There was a few mentions of new things. And it was interesting, actually, I think, particularly the one area that I would sort of want to dwell on briefly is this business of trying to ensure that Russian money stays in Russia, both because it's part of the whole anti-corruption shtick, and also because, let's be honest, you need to have the Russian elite having some stake in Russia's future. If they can think, well, if things go terrible here, it doesn't matter because all my money is currently in Geneva, then obviously they have a different mindset. But the key thing was this was all very, very familiar. We've heard all of this before. Now, it might well be that this is the president who cries wolf, and that this time he really means all these things about the pivot to Asia, about Russia's new role in the world, about investing in all these other areas. But for me, the key thing was precisely that of all times, as we mentioned, now he needed a strong speech. We've had a year, frankly, of drift. First half of the year, the opposition was, as you've said in the previous podcast, very much kind of calling the shots in terms of the public conversation. In the second half of the year, they've lost that political initiative, but the state has not regained it. And I think, therefore, this was an opportunity for Putin to come all out and actually be able to make some really striking statement that perhaps sort of reasserted that, in fact, power is in Moscow's hands, Moscow knows what it's doing, and more to the point, people have a reason to believe in Moscow. I didn't see anything of that here. Appropriate levels of dullness are a fine modulation to avoid further trouble. But this was a chance for him to be, I think, audacious, and he certainly wasn't that.
Well, it seems to me that the difference in what you two are saying is Kirill's kind of describing the new normal, basically. Everybody's scaled back their ambitions. The state is scaling back its ambitions. The opposition's scaling back its ambitions. They're not expecting a revolution tomorrow. And everything's kind of settled into this kind of Cold War-style status quo that's more or less suits everybody a little bit, but doesn't give everybody what they really want. You're saying Putin had a chance, Mark, for a breakthrough,
yes,
and that he missed that breakthrough. I guess I'll go back to you, Mark. What would such a breakthrough possibly look like?
I think really, I mean, in some ways, exactly what the content, the policy would have been, would have mattered much less from a sense that there had been difference. I think the thing is that, you know, most ordinary Russians are not the people who went out on Bolotnaya and so forth. Most ordinary Russians do not necessarily have some grand designs. They're not looking for regime change or whatever. But they are, I think, that there is a generalized sense of malaise, a sense that actually the status quo, it's not disastrous for most people, but nor is it really working. And the gap between the often quite grandiose rhetoric of the Kremlin and the realities of most people's lives is, I think, increasingly strong. And in its own, you know, very different way, it is a little reminiscent of late Brezhnevism and this just sense of drift and decline. Now, this was an opportunity, because in a way this is the first time Putin has had a set-piece opportunity since his inauguration to actually say, either we've been listening to you and we really are going to address those issues, which would have involved acknowledging errors made, or to actually have created some whole new dramatic vision for what Russia's future lay. I think the thing is, yes, this doesn't make anything worse. This allows the drift to continue, and it's a drift which is not disastrous, and it's not an impending pre-revolutionary situation or anything like that. But we really can't ignore the power of momentum. States are meant to be governing legitimate and, you know, above all, inspiring beasts, because after all, states are essentially creations of the imagination. I found little to suggest that Putin had the capacity to engage with the national imagination. And in that respect, I think, therefore, the drift will continue. And that's, I think, very, you know, slowly, but nonetheless, very dangerous to the government for it not to have managed to reacquire control of the national conversation and the national imagination. Mm-hmm.
Now, Kirill, your new normal. I'll give you a chance to respond to Mark in a second. But you were describing to me yesterday this new normal that we're in, that this situation that suits everybody to a degree. Can you describe that and where that might go and what that might mean? Because Mark's describing what Mark describes as drift you describe as almost the new status quo that kind of sort of suits everybody. Where could that go? Where could that lead to?
But the very idea of the status quo is in the minds of Putin and some political elite groups and social groups, but not in the reality. And that is very interesting. So I'd like to change my position of observation or point of observation, not point of view, but point of observation.
Your vantage point.
Yes. Because previously I spoke from the point of view. I was speaking about PR effects of Putin's speech. And now I'd like to say some words objectively about the situation in Russia. It's absolutely different, of course. First of all, the society is divided. The latest poll about population's attitude to protests in forthcoming tomorrow, the opinion is absolutely divided. 40% they are for protests, and 40 or 41, something like this, is against. So that is the answer. The Russian society is deeply divided, still deeply divided, and no any Putin's speeches as well as Akunin's speech, I'm speaking about the opposition and so on, couldn't veil this fact, this obvious fact.
Well, it could win over that 20% in the middle.
Yes, but 20% is not 40%.
So 20 plus 40 is 60.
Yes,
which is
okay, but they could be 20 plus 40 on the one side, and it could be on the other side and of barricades, and that is very dangerous. So, because it's not a real balance. Because if you want to have a real balance, like in the Russian toy Matryoshka, which never fall. You have to have a very heavy, something heavy in the middle. Not on the wings of of your spectrum, political spectrum, if you will, back to political language. Yes, but in the middle. And if you have 20% in the middle and 40% on the right and the left, I'm not speaking in political terms, right, like, but against or for Putin. So that is very dangerous. Secondly, of course, the main, for me, speaking objectively, the main problem or the main error or mistake or even in some sense crime of Putin's speech is a lack of image of future. So that is the problem, that there are no any real, and we told about this before several times, there are no any real image of the future, country's future, people's future, and so on in public, sorry for my jargon, in public discourse now in Russia. That is the real problem, and that is the problem of Putin himself, that is the problem of Kremlin, and that is the problem of opposition.
So it seems that this, you're saying that this term has no agenda.
The only agenda is that we, authorities, opposition, whoever, government, we don't have any fresh ideas. And that is the only fresh idea that we understand. We understand that we don't have fresh ideas. That is the point. And that's why I think this speech was, in some sense, symbolic.
So, Mark, what do you think this portends? I mean, are we destined to stay in this holding pattern that we described in last week's podcast for another, few months, year, 6 months? What does this portend about where we are?
Well, it implies that we are, really, until something happens to actually break the status quo. I mean, I very much want to agree with Kirill when you said about the sort of the danger of the situation where you haven't really got a middle. Because another way of thinking about it is, and we quite often see people saying, well, look, Putin's popularity ratings are down, but then if you compare them with Western politicians, they often have very low popularity ratings. What's the big deal? But of course, the difference is, in a Western system, it's actually the system that has legitimacy. You could well be for or against President Obama, but you nonetheless believe in the American constitutional ideal and the democratic system and so forth. Now, in Russia, frankly, the system is Putin, is the current regime. there is no sense of systemic legitimacy compared with actually the legitimacy of the state. So anyway, we're talking about a situation now in which actually for the majority of Russians, either they believe there is something wrong, they are delegitimizing the system, or else they don't really care. And in this situation, you know, again, I really wouldn't want to overplay this, but it is politically brittle. There is, I think, the scope for some kind of sort of relatively rapid and unpredictable changes. And given that Putin's vision is entirely technical, not technocratic, but it's all about, well, basically, broadly speaking, as far as Putin's concerned, what he's saying is the status quo, what we have now, is fine. We'd like to tweak elements of it. You know, we want to have the army even stronger with shinier new tanks. We'd want to ensure that we get a better share of the potential tax revenue, etc. You know, these minor sort of incremental changes. But in systemic terms, what Putin is saying is everything is fine. And the point is, what is increasingly clear within the country is everything is not fine. And it's hard to see how that can be bridged. And I think this is it. This is one of the key moments for Putin to show that he had some vision which could bridge that divide. And he's either not got it, which I think is the case, or else just simply not chosen to show it. So yeah, for the moment, in a way, where can Putin go? He's missed a key opportunity to, for example, rebrand himself. And we talked about whether that would really work or not. But nonetheless, you know, if that was the idea, this was going to be the opportunity. The anti-corruption campaign continues. But it's not really, I think, taken root in the national imagination, because clearly it's so limited in what happens.
And people don't trust that it's really an anti-corruption campaign.
Exactly. So, I mean, it's hard to say, well, what has he got to offer? And the answer is nothing, and therefore I think he's clearly still in this situation, basically just hoping that the whole ferment dies down or something emerges which pulls him out of this hole.
Can this holding pattern carry on indefinitely, or do you think we will hit some point where it will stagnate to the point where something has to give?
Well, it can certainly last for a long time. I mean, nothing lasts forever, and you know, everything will eventually sort of hit some crunch point. But the point is that, in a way, what this means is the state loses initiative. Now, it's lucky at the moment that there is no great pressure being exerted on it by the opposition. There is no Lenin out there or whatever. I suppose it's like, you know, you can throw a handful of dice and you throw them and you throw them and it's fine. Someday they're all going to come up one. Mm. You know, I think it's this point, it's actually relying on inertia and momentum works for a certain length of time. But the point is, it more or less means that you relinquish the initiative to fate. And who knows who's going to come up? Who knows what new event is suddenly going to challenge? I mean, if, for example, there was some new natural disaster, would that catalyze opinion, if it was handled badly, against the Kremlin? If all of a sudden some new political figure or force emerged out of nowhere, if all of a sudden there was just, you know, or if something happened to Putin, mm-hmm. you know, all of these what-ifs now become incredibly potentially dangerous.
It's not only the regime that's in inertia, Kirill, or kind of comfortable in this holding pattern. We were talking yesterday about how Akunin's indicator that we don't want revolution.
Yes.
How important is this? Has there been a change on the opposition side in how they're going to? Are they truly scaling back their ambitions?
I think that is in some sense a reaction to. Lack of, very hard, very brutal political measures against opposition. I think everyone in this summer in opposition was waiting for, you know, some repressions, huge repressions. But what we see now, of course, we have the persecution of several opposition activists.
New charges against Navalny today.
Yes, but it's not, you know, on a great scale. And everyone, you know, waited for this. And in some sense, some of the opposition leaders, they even wanted to be a victim of this, to inflict some, you know, new feelings into the opposition activity and so on. But in this sense, in this field, in this area, nothing happened, or almost nothing happened. Secondly, the division of Russian opposition, all of us perfectly know that there are, you know, leftists, Beltsovs, and there are nationalists, there are liberals, and so on. This division is deeper and deeper every day.
There's also another division developing that I've written about on the blog, and that's the division between those who are willing to accommodate and negotiate with the regime.
Yes.
And those who want nothing short of then regime change. And
yes.
Mr. Navalny seems to be moving closer to the accommodationists and to
yes.
those in favor, as has Ksenia Sobchak and others. And that and maybe not the left-right division, but that may end up being the key division within the opposition.
I think that is the division between so-called, I'm just stressing, so-called common sense, and so-called revolutionary, you know,
so-called
temper. not principles, revolutionary, you know, temper. And in this sense, that is a very interesting psychological division between those who were, you know, waited for, you know, immediate changes in Russia and those who, from the very beginning of the struggle, was absolutely sure that it's a very, very, very long way ahead.
Yes.
And that is very interesting because I remember this first euphoria after the first demonstrations and rallies and protests in Moscow, that just one more step, one more knock, one more blow, and the regime will, you know, fall.
But if you're looking at it from a bird's eye view, it was clear this was not the case.
Yes, yes. But in some sense, I cannot, you know, agree that I was a part of these aspirations and so on. But anyway, on the psychological level, almost everyone thought something like this. Felt something like this.
Mm-hmm.
And now we, all of us, not just those who participate in these processes, but those who are experts or observers and so on, all of us, in some sense, we need to sober up.
On Friday? Are you kidding me?
Yes.
Well, in a few moments, we'll continue our discussion and look at the fallout from a little gaffe by Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev that drew the ire of the law enforcement community. I'd like to remind you, you are listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me is my regular co-host, Kirill Coburn of RFERL's Russian service. And on the Skype line from New York City is NYU professor and longtime Kremlin watcher, Mark Galeotti, author of numerous books on Russia and author of the must-read blog In Moscow Shadows. I'd also like to remind you, you can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org. You can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, and you can follow us on Twitter at Power Vertical. Last week, Dmitry Medvedev learned something that U.S. presidents from Ronald Reagan to Barack Obama also learned the hard way. Beware of live microphones. In casual comments to journalists after a television interview on December 7th, a live mic picked up Medvedev referring to agents of the investigative committee as, quote, kozly, which literally means goats in Russian, but which anybody who knows the language also knows is a deeply offensive insult. It originated as prison slang for inmates who collaborated with the authorities, but has since evolved into general usage as a slur that, when used, often results in a fight. When Medvedev's gaffe went viral on the internet, it drew a sharp response from the investigative committee and its spokesman, Vladimir Markin, who said the comment, quote, denigrates the investigative committee and, quote, undermines the work of the country's law enforcement agencies. But as the Daily Izvestia reported this week, what really angered the investigative committee brass was not so much the unfortunate kozly gaffe, but something Medvedev said in the on-the-record part of his television interview. Discussing the case of former Defense Minister Anatoly Serdyukov, who was sacked over a corruption scandal, Medvedev stressed that he was an effective minister and should be considered innocent until proven guilty. Mark, we've discussed this in the past. During Medvedev's presidency, he and Serdyukov appeared to be using each other for their own purposes. And Medvedev wasn't happy about Serdyukov getting fired. From my perspective, it seems that all this illustrates the discord that Putin's crackdown on dissent and his more recent campaign against corruption is causing in the ruling elite. Is that how you see it?
Yes, I would. And in fact, I'd add actually one additional layer to that, which I think it also says a lot about the investigative committee and its current mindset and, frankly, its current arrogance. It is really quite striking that, a perhaps rather unfortunate off-mic gaffe gets caught. But Markin doesn't so much complain because the head of the government was using particular language and that the investigative committee agents were therefore hurt. He was actually essentially challenging the prime minister's right to be able to comment on a case.
Yeah.
He was precisely sort of feeling that he could actually chastise the prime minister. And again, taking issue with the notion that Serdyukov should be considered innocent until proven guilty. You know, this is not some, you know, convicted murderer or whatever. This is someone who was dismissed simply because he was too close to a running anti-corruption investigation, which is fair enough. I mean, one can dispute whether or not that's fair. I mean, it's not that I want necessarily to defend Serdyukov. It's more that I'd like to see the same principles apply to a lot of other ministers. But it's that basic point that almost how dare the prime minister support someone whom we think is guilty. And that really, I thought, was quite striking about how the sort of the current new generation of Chekists or Oprichniki, feel confident. It's hard to imagine, for example, the a spokesperson for the director of the FBI feeling that actually he could, with impunity, attack a sort of, if not the president, a senior member of the cabinet.
I was interested in, like, Medvedev here getting caught out telling the truth, basically. One part of it, unintentionally, right? The Kozli comment picked up by the live mic. He did not intend that to be, unless you believe in some conspiracy theory here. He did not intend that to get out there into the public domain. He was bantering with journalists casually, trying to be all friendly with them, and said, "No, of course they're all a bunch of Kozli," in referring to the investigative. But the part about Serdyukov, that was in the on the record part of the interview that Medvedev, that he was clearly sending a message there about Serdyukov. Mm-hmm. What's your takeaway from that?
2 points, I think I would say. First of all, specific to Serdyukov, I mean, it clearly does demonstrate this point that actually Medvedev was not happy with the process. Not happy, I think, both because he found some common ground with Serdyukov, as well as a genuine recognition of the fact that this was a guy who was doing a pretty decent job in a very hard position. But I think the second thing is, and I do think we have to remember this, is that although it's so easy, and we've done it many a time, to dismiss Medvedev as being, this simple sort of puppet of Putin's or whatever, Medvedev is a figure with his own agenda and his own ideas. And one of the things that has always underpinned Medvedev's notion is this perhaps slightly stunted and sad, but nonetheless genuine belief in the rule of law, genuine belief in process. It's striking just how both Medvedev and Putin were trained as lawyers, and Putin, frankly, never internalized any of it, and Medvedev did. And therefore, I think there is this deeply buried but nonetheless visceral sense within Medvedev that actually rule of law should matter. Doesn't mean you have to have nice laws. It doesn't mean that he's a Democrat monqué. But nonetheless, the idea is process and so forth matters. And therefore, I think what happened to Serdyukov offended him on that level too. So, it shows that even within the top levels of the power elite, there are variations in opinion. It also shows something, I think, the very fact that Medvedev is willing to make this statement. And again, it's something that we've talked about, is the fact that at the moment he's showing himself to be a little bit more independent than he has in the past. Now, in part, that might show that he's just simply unhappy with the situation. In part, it might show that he feels he might be sacked and wants to sort of raise his stake and his price. In part, it may be that he wants to signal that he is a potential, some way down the line, figure who could reach out from within the current elite and perhaps sort of address some of the more moderate non-revolutionary concerns of the sort of the technocratic opposition, if we put it that way. I mean, there's all kinds of ways of parsing it, but the key thing is that he felt willing to say that exactly on the record. Because in effect, by doing that, yes, he was picking a fight with the Investigations Committee. He wasn't naive enough not to realize that. But by proxy, he was, if not picking a fight, but certainly signaling a slight degree of distance between himself and Putin.
Mm-hmm. We also know that he was, late in his presidency, courting Serdyukov as an ally. He was definitely doing that. And as you've correctly pointed out, it's a stretch to call them allies. But Serdyukov was certainly using Medvedev to get increased funding for armaments, for example, against Kudrin's wishes, which is at least the nominal reason that Kudrin ended up resigning. He seemed to be trying to, and it shows me that Medvedev was very serious about seeking a second term. If he was courting somebody of the stature of Serdyukov, maybe his own little personal Silovik there. And I know you're skeptical of the, and I'm not sure what I think about it myself, about the notion that the real reason Serdyukov was fired was that Putin did not look kindly on Serdyukov playing footsie with Medvedev there in the second term game. Do you see anything there?
I think it's one of these things that I don't think it was the cause of his sacking, because let's face it, Putin knows that he's safe, at least at the moment, and certainly from Medvedev. It's not, I think, that he would be worried about Serdyukov playing footsie with Medvedev, as you put it in a slightly disturbing image. I think it's more that, we know that Putin doesn't like anything that questions his centrality within the system. Mm-hmm. And particularly when Putin feels slightly isolated, slightly sort of taken off guard, he, instead of reaching out, he tends to feel the need to reassert his manliness. And what better way of doing that than by a really good sacking? I think that basically meant that Serdyukov was vulnerable. And when a whole variety of other issues arose, it meant that he was a clear and logical candidate to go. But as I said, I think in some ways this moves into the realms of the sort of the psychology of power rather than actually power itself.
Well, the most into Serdyukov is also vulnerable in the opinion of a lot of things that have been written in the Russian press, because his marriage to the daughter of Zubkov, a close Putin ally, broke up, and he lost a very, very important Krisha in the elite.
It's like France ancien regime.
So it gets more and more interesting the deeper you look at it. Before we wrap up, I wanted to turn to a completely different topic. Kirill, during your travels in the Great White North, in the Arctic lands, it seems you found a little place in Norway where they love Russians any place more than any place outside of Russia.
And in Russia itself.
Tell me what you found in the northernmost town in the world.
It's Kirkenes. It's on a very northern, east north point of Norway. It's a small town, 10,000 inhabitants, just near two borders. It's very interesting. It's this region, Finnmark, is near Russian border and Finnish border. And Kirkenes is a port on the Barents Sea. And it's really very, very interesting, because there I just it just occurred to me that in this place, it's not just a small town, it's an attitude of the whole northern part of Norway. That attitude to Russia is absolutely different than from, even from, Sweden, or if you're speaking about northern Europe or some other countries. And moreover, it's absolutely different attitude from, self-hate style of Russian attitude to themselves. What is the reason? The reason is economy and geography. First of all, Kirkenes is a port and near Russian border, and there are a very, very, very close ties between Russian territory and Norway territory, Norwegian territory in this region. Russian trawler fleet use this port and docks all over the year. all over the year. And the only ships which you can find there in port and in dock are Russian trawlers. Secondly, they use Russian human power. It's very interesting. No one knows that there are a 30 kilometers free visa zone between even between Norway as a part of European Union and Russia. And Russian workers can freely come to Norway for a week or for a month to work there and so on. And Norwegian businessmen and even Norwegian state government is very happy with this because they praise Russian workers much higher than the workers from other parts of European Union. It's very interesting. First of all, they told me several times that they're sober. secondly, they never fell sick. So there are no any, you know, they never
call in sick.
Yes, and so on. And thirdly, this attitude. This is a result of a real economic cooperation. It's not. You know, the case when Russians came to some European place or some other places with the bags of cash, buying everything all over, you know, the country and so on. No, it's a very... economic ties are very, very strong, but on the not this, you know, oligarch style. It's a real economic cooperation between small and medium companies in Russia and Norway, and that is very important. So we can say that, in some sense, the real cooperation, and that is the real cooperation, is more, you know, useful and effective than any other ways of dealing between, you know, in some sense, between European Union and Russia. Mm-hmm. That is first very interesting lesson from this visit. Second one is it's not on the modest, but on the global level. No one in Norway, you know, on the high north, so-called high north, it's a term from this place, is high north. No one... you know, can be dubious about global warming. They don't just you know believe in global warming. They all of them know that it happening just now.
They see it every day.
They see this every day, and they used to see it every day. So I'd like, of course, to speak this things to, you know, Czech President Václav Klaus and so on, because there are people who really see this global warming and melting of the ices there every day. Every day, but they came from the, you know, this despair, worries, and so on to the idea how to use this. And that is, I was told about a absolutely, you know, monstrous, grandiose plans to use a northern sea passage, you know, to bring its most direct and short way from China and Far East to bring goods from Far East to Europe through Northern Pole. Because all this, you know, ices are melting and using Russian, by the way, Russian nuclear icebreakers, because Russia is the only one country who has this fleet, just to bring this all these goods and Chinese, you know, production, all this Far East production to Europe, and then to use the same way to transport the oil, gas, and so on and so on. That is very serious. And I was told in Kirkenes that some Chinese company already came there and asked them, you know, to propose them to build a cargo terminal there. So that is very serious.
Chinese certainly do plan for the future, don't
yes,
they?
Yes, yes, yes. And in all these plans, which revitalize the life, economic life in this region, by the way, it's not poor, Russia plays a very important, maybe crucial role. So that's why, the second point, that's why this attitude to Russia is very serious, very objective, and very realistic.
It's very nice to, for once, end the podcast on a very positive note. Mark, last word to you. Anything to say to all that? Because I found it quite fascinating.
I think it is interesting that, well, apart from the fact that clearly whoever's managing the Russian laborers at Kirkenes ought to be hired by Putin straight away. but I mean, I think it is interesting exactly that when we concentrate on what's going on in the Kremlin, it's very easy to precisely see things in quite doom and gloom concepts. But in fact, actually, Russia... potentially can have a tremendous role within Europe as part of Europe, as well as a partner for Europe. But exactly, it's almost when the state is taken out of the equation, that's when things seem to work most effectively.
All right. Well, it's very nice to end, as I said, on a positive note. And unfortunately, that's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you've been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me has been my regular co-host, Kirill Kobrin of RFERL's Russian service. And on the Skype line from New York City has been NYU professor and longtime Kremlin watcher, Mark Galliotti, author of the must-read blog, In Moscow Shadows. Thanks for the great discussion, guys.
Thank you.
Always a pleasure.
I'd also like to thank our brilliant producer, Tanya Kancheva, and my indispensable colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the equally indispensable Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. Join us again next week for what will be our last podcast of 2012, but we'll be back again next year. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.